Columbus, W224 EG Madison, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger. The massive park fire, which is alleged to have been intentionally set, is now the fifth largest fire in the history of California.
Fire officials hoping to get a handle on this fire, but it is expected to burn for at least a few more weeks. In the meanwhile, they will likely have their hands full for at least the next few days, as extreme triple-digit temperatures are expected to move into the area, potentially creating some very difficult conditions for firefighters on the ground.
ABC's Mola Lenghi in Butte County. Vice President Kamala Harris told voters at an Atlanta rally that she would address price gouging on day one if she's elected. Her campaign announcing the likely Democratic presidential nominee will crisscross the country with her running mate starting next Tuesday. Former President Trump will take part in a question and answer session tomorrow at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention in Chicago. After days of questions over water quality and the Seine, the men's and women's Olympic triathlon begins tomorrow. This is ABC News.
I'm Terry Bell with WMDX News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WMDX website at mad.radio.
Civic Media News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Wisconsin's young people are in a mental health crisis. That's according to new survey results from the Department of Public Instruction. 59% of high school students said they've dealt with at least one mental health challenge in the past year. State Superintendent Dr. Jill Underley says schools need more mental health services. Kamala Harris is running for president, but overall, fewer women are running for office across the country this fall. Princeton University's Debbie Walsh.
Women have been essential to flipping the most competitive seats in recent election years, and women of color have been winning both statewide executive and legislative seats in states and districts with majority white electorates.
Record numbers of women were elected to Congress in the last three cycles, but now the Center for American Women in Politics says the numbers have dropped off this year. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
The John and Gordy Show.
People don't realize there used to be radio schools.
It was night school, and my very first day, I walk up the stairs, and there in the lobby is my instructor. He's laying on the couch, his arm over his head, and he's going, "Oh my God, I wish I'd gotten into real estate." That was the encouragement I got right away.
Weekday mornings 6 until 8 on Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to Mad Radio WMDX, home of the John and Gordy Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Getting weird out there, and I'm sure creepy's not too far behind, as people are finally looking at the right-wing commentators and the right-wing billionaires and, well, Donald Trump himself, and going little weird and getting weirder every day. And understand, next will be creepy because there's a lot of creepy stuff that goes on. And then maybe there's healing on the other side of realizing that the likes of Elon Musk, the Twitter guy or X or whatever they're calling it, the Trumps of the world. These angry old white guys, something wrong there. And weird kind of describes it. You know, I look at Musk, someone who bought Twitter so that he could open it up and make it free speech, because he's Mr. Free Speech, which is not weird. It's not. We should encourage free speech, not hateful, not attacking, that kind of stuff. He then uses it to block people he just doesn't like. For instance, the Pete Souza guy, who was a photographer all during the Obama years, took a picture of Donald Trump's ear. And it doesn't look like there's anything there. Musk banned him. Now, Musk himself retweeted an altered video of Kamala Harris. But that's okay. And look, I don't know that it's illegal to do that yet. It should be. it should be illegal to put this kind of altered content out there. Because understand, when someone like Musk tweets that along to the weird and creepy minions, it gets worse. Now, as I've been paying attention to some of the commentators who are losing their ever loving freaking mind and going really off the deep end, you look at this Tim Pool, I think his name is. Who said that in a tweet that, Kamala's Project Special K makes Project 2025 look like daycare. She's going to force women to get abortions. She's going to send military to kidnap poor Hondurans and make them live in your home. She's going to start 800 new wars. And you go, now look, I know a lot of people who listen to these guys. And you know they're going to take the Fox News defense, which, no reasonable person would believe that Kamala Harris is going to force every woman to have an abortion, or that we're really going to go into Honduras and kidnap citizens and make them live in America. We're never going to do that. Or 800 wars? No reasonable person would believe that. Have you looked at the weird that's going on? Do you remember the whole gold statue thing at CPAC last year or the year before, where people were literally bowing down to the gold god of Trump? Have you not seen the people walking around in full Trump regalia from shoes to hat? It's a little weird. It's a little weird. But the thing is it's dangerous weird. Because I came across this guy, this Andrew Klavan, I believe is his name is. He's a host of a podcast on the Daily Wire. And he went on some bizarre... The rant was weird in that, he said the central purpose of every society is to figure out the distribution of women. And that women can't take care of themselves. They need a man. And... As a man, we like to believe that. And I know women, believe that they can take care of themselves. Absolutely. I thought his rant should have gone is, a democracy works better when we work together. When people get together and commingle because they want to, not because they're a product to be sorted out. Not because women are a commodity and we need to distribute them properly to ensure, humanity going forward. No, we'll figure that out. And then he went into some weird kind of, the strong survive and take all the women. It was just this bizarre, twisted old guy rant that fits perfectly into the weird moment that we are. And you go, well, that's just some crazy guy on a podcast. And it's true. It's just some crazy guy in a podcast until you start to realize that a lot of the nonsense and rhetoric that people like him are spewing are now what our vice presidential candidate for the Republicans believes. He said in 2021 that, people without kids, they shouldn't be in leadership roles. Why is this just a normal fact of life for leaders in our country to be people who don't have a personal or direct stake in it via their own offspring? Because why would you want to leave a healthy planet? Why would you want to do anything positive for the future of humanity? Why would you want to do that if you don't have children? A little secret. Have you seen the decisions people have made with children? If his argument were true, and I would argue that the people without kids had them because they're afraid of what the future didn't have them because they're afraid of what the future is, and they're probably trying to stop what people like J.D. Vance want to do. Now, this is a guy who's going on this weird rant about childless people. What is it, the childless cat lady thing? Childless cat lady. understand, he's a guy who said, we don't want people without kids around our kids to, they'll brainwash them. And you just go, oh, okay. And why? He's tweeted out that daycare, universal daycare, he said, is class war against normal people. And I'm going, wait a minute. I know normal people who can't afford childcare. It's one of the biggest issues facing the working class. Now, understand, the world that he envisions is a 1950s kind of world where women are in their place, kitchen, barefoot, minorities were back in the fields, gays were back in the closet, you know, where American conservatism wants things. But he doesn't want to go and say, well, the reason that that was even possible was because, you know, men were making decent money. They could support a family on one income. There were opportunities here for people with you know, basic education, decent education, to get good jobs, to lead a family-sustaining lifestyle. We don't have that. And it's people like Vance who have created this environment where that doesn't happen. And I don't care what my president of the Teamsters Union says about J.D. Vance. He's no working-class hero. And again, this is a guy who you know, wants to set up networks to follow women to ensure that they don't have abortions. It's crazy. It's weird. But it's where we are. And it's who these, honest, quite frankly, it's who these people are. They're telling us. They're open. They're honest. They're direct with how weird and creepy and crazy they are. The question is, will you vote for this? Is this something that you're willing to go to the ballot box and go, yeah, I want me some crazy. I want the special kind of crazy that the J.D. Vances and the Climans and the Pools want to shove down our throats. We'll see. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. President Biden's got an op-ed out. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Monday, President Biden came out with an op-ed calling on the creation of another amendment to our Constitution. Something to do with the Supreme Court. Evidently, there is a presidential commission on the Supreme Court of the U.S. So the op-ed focused on, hey, how do we limit... how do we have limit immunity for presidents since the Supreme Court kind of messed that up? Term limits and then a code of ethics for our Supreme Court. Because he wrote, what's happening now is not normal. And it undermines the public's confidence in the court's decisions, including those impacting personal freedoms. We now stand in a breach. And here to share some thoughts on the op-ed and, you know, what we should be doing with our Supreme Court, or if it's broken or just fine as it is. I've asked Devin Ombres to come talk with us. Devin's a senior director for courts and legal policy there at the Center for American Progress, americanprogress.org, the website. Devin, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I'm sure you've seen the op-ed. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. We need to limit it. You know, we need to limit what a president can do. We need to impose some term limits. He said 18 years, I guess. And maybe not have Supreme Court justices on the dole of billionaires. Seems reasonable.
It seems like an entirely reasonable ask. And this is actually something that we've been working on at CAP for more than a minute. We came out in support of term limits, I want to say back in 22. The president had his commission on the United States Supreme Court when he was first elected. They came out with a number of recommendations. One of the things that they said was feasible was term limits. They said ethics are feasible. They went into a lot more detail about things like jurisdiction stripping and such. But those are the three big things that I think are critical at this point: ethics, term limits, and rebutting the wild constitutional theory that presidents are kings, that five justices plus one in some circumstances provided to presidents in Trump v. U.S. a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, no, I mean, it makes that whole Nixon thing seem kind of quaint.
If this had been around when Nixon was facing Watergate, he would have just said, you know what, it actually is true. When the president does it, it's not illegal. That's what the Supreme Court said.
Yeah, it's amazing how in my lifetime things have changed that drastically to where, he could literally shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. Absolutely. But, you know, on the term limit front, you know, I'm opposed to the idea of term limits for representatives and for Congress and stuff, because I believe that, you know, we have the ultimate term limiter, which is the right to go and vote. And, you know, we can throw the bums out when they don't do the right job. But the Supreme Court, I don't know. That's one of those things where, you know, for life seems, well, too long. And I think 18 years sounds like a long enough tenure to spend on the court. And maybe it's time to maybe go spend some time with the grandkids. Just a thought.
What would think so? I mean, back when all the Constitution was written, life expectancy was a little bit shorter than it is today. And even throughout history, Supreme Court justices serve on average about 18 years, give or take. But now we see people sitting on the court for 30, 40 years, and it just becomes untenable. We've seen Alito and Thomas become untethered with what it means to be a regular everyday American when they're palling around with billionaires on their private yachts in Alaska or Tahiti or what have you, and just kind of becoming untethered from any form of normalcy. And they're using it to not expand democracy, not expand freedoms, but shrink our democracy, take our voting rights away, take our women's right to choose away, preventing people from being able to be protected from giant corporations. That's what they're doing anymore. And so I think it's entirely reasonable, a response to the Trump v. U.S. decision, to begin implementing these changes.
Now, the call was to pass a constitutional amendment. And when I saw that, I got to be honest, my mind went to, we can't even name a post office without there being some kind of an argument. How do you get the threshold that you would need? What is it, 290 in the House and 67 in the Senate, plus what, I think 3/4 of the states to pass the constitutional amendment? I never see another amendment ever happening to our Constitution, especially I don't think this one.
I mean, I'm a lawyer, so I'm bad at math, but I think that everybody in the country should be 100% behind an amendment that says presidents have to abide by the laws of the nation just like everybody else does. I mean, if you want to create some type of very narrow system where true core constitutional powers don't fall under a prosecutable type of rubric, I think that could be worked out possibly. But everything, we managed to not have to prosecute a president for about 250 years until now, because everybody believed that the law applies to everybody. I mean, Alito, Thomas, Kavanaugh, Roberts all said in their confirmation hearings, no man is above the law. The law applies to presidents. And then 3 weeks ago, they said, ha ha, just kidding. No, it doesn't. So this isn't left or right. This is a core tenet of foundational American principles, that the law applies to everybody. And I think, you know, I have hopes that this is something that certainly can be passed, because if Donald Trump is adamant in wanting to prosecute everybody under the sun for whatever nonsense he makes up, well, Joe Biden has complete presidential immunity for everything that he's done for the past 4 years. So it's, I think, correct and decent and good. And it's something that should be done.
Yeah, no, that wrong circle. I mean, you've got some. Have you seen Trump lately? Have you seen some of the weird stuff coming out of his mouth? Do you think decent and good? And I think I'm struggling with that one.
As a Floridian who grew up doing like a lot of offshore fishing, I can promise you that electrocuting sharks was not something that ever came to mind when I was like 5-6 miles offshore. But maybe that's a thing at Mar-a-Lago that they do. I don't know.
Electrocuting sharks. No, he didn't want to get eaten by a shark. He would rather be electrocuted by the batteries we're going to put on boats, not like there are batteries on boats today.
Okay, so that just weird nonsense. It didn't compute because I heard electrocution and sharks and a crazy guy rambling.
Yeah, and throwing some windmills in there, and it's all bad then, right?
Oh God, let's not talk about.
Let's not get to the windmills. No, I'm with you because, you know, look, we're in a really bizarre place because, you know, when I grew up as a kid, you know, the Supreme Court was revered. You know, you didn't see this kind of craziness, and now you've got, you know, Supreme Court justices who seem to want to get their hands in the policy aims of the country and want to be, you know, little dictators in robes.
Yeah. Remember when Roberts was confirmed, he said, we're here to call balls and strikes and we're, you know, arbiters of the law. And you go back to Federalist number 78, Alexander Hamilton says the Supreme Court is the weakest of the branches who cannot usurp the power of the president or the power of Congress. And this iteration of the court has proved that exactly wrong, because they're saying, no, Congress, you can't do this. No, president, you can't do that. And we're going to use our power to strip the rights away from Americans. And we're going to do it. And you can't do anything about it.
Right. No. And you know, this most recent decision, the Chevron doctrine going by the wayside, is another grab of power, I think, by the courts. No.
Oh, 100%. But the kicker is, to kind of get back to ethics and term limits, in light of the Trump opinion, the Supreme Court has effectively decided that there are 10 people in this country who are above the law, the president, for virtually anything he does, and the 9 Supreme Court justices who federal ethics statutes have no bearing on whatsoever. There's a recusal statute that should have required Thomas and Alito to step away from Trump v. U.S. and all of the J6 cases, and really any case involving financial benefits to their billionaire benefactors. And they just said, we don't really think that this applies to us. So not only is the president above the law, but in a certain sense, the Supreme Court justices are too. And it's so critical that Congress steps in and says, we are the primary policymakers in this country. We make the laws. The Supreme Court gets to interpret some of them, but yeah. You don't get to make the law. We do.
Now, what's interesting is some of the reporting that I'm seeing coming out of it is, you know, Dick Durbin and the Judiciary Committee seem kind of shocked by this. Didn't realize this op-ed was coming out because there's no legislative part of this, as I understand. And you being in D.C., maybe you've heard something different, but this seems like, from my point of view, a messaging vehicle to go, hey, our court's broken. Maybe we should be talking about this.
Yeah, we should be talking about it. Dick Durbin should have been doing something for a long time, including holding a lot of hearings about Supreme Court corruption and about what's going on. We've got a hearing coming up in September. He should have held the hearing back in March, but I can't tell them what to do. The fact of the matter is there's a number of bills out there about term limits, about court expansion, about ethics, but they're all kind of piecemeal and scattershot, and there hasn't been a concerted effort yet. And that's why I think this is important. Bring it all under one bill, get folks behind it, because it's things that are just basic good governance. And we at CAP put out a report last Thursday highlighting exactly how we think term limits combined with ethics can increase the constitutionality of each provision and what Congress should be thinking about when they're doing it.
No, it sounds great. But, you know, so walk me through some of that then. You know, how would this right the ship? I mean, because who's to say that, you know, even with term limits and even, you know, with something of a code of ethics, you know, maybe with teeth or without, that we don't end up in a situation where you have, and the fear that I think some folks have is these wide ideological swings from, you know, extreme right to, well, normal.
All right. Well, I'm going to go put on my nerd policy hat since you asked me. But I think we make it 18-year term limits. Every president gets 2 to provide some normalcy. We can talk about Senate blocking it via various mechanisms. But I think if we look back to the actual constitutional text, it says that Supreme Court justices can hold their offices during good behavior. And in 1948, Congress created the concept of senior justices. Well, if we say justices still take senior status, they still hold their office, but now they have the added role of being arbiters of ethical opinions and decisions for motions to recuse by the court. Well, that keeps their hand in their office. If justices have to recuse because of X, Y, or Z, or there's an illness, death, or other disability that prevents a full nine from sitting, we can have senior justices sit by lottery, and we can provide other requirements of these senior justices to write opinions in per curiam affirmances, in other decisions that allow them to still hold that title of office while not being actively hearing, cases on appeal. We leave that to the nine junior ones. The other thing that I think is important is to pass constitutional muster is it has to apply prospectively. We do have to grandfather in the sitting justices for better or for worse, but I think that's what makes it constitutional, and that's what makes it palatable for the nine that are currently sitting there to say, okay, this doesn't necessarily apply to us. Well, I'm not going to worry about it then. It can apply to the folks ahead of us.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, you look at Barrett, you look at Kavanaugh, you look at Gorsuch, they're still relatively young. There's a lot of bad decisions coming down the road. At least that's my thought on it. Now, the one thing that this doesn't bring up is, and I've got friends who are just losing their minds over the fact that we're not expanding the court to 13. And there's been a lot of talk around how we got to nine. Did the other ones fall off the horse, or I don't know, how did we get to nine? And why are they calling for 13?
I mean, I think with the opinions that we're seeing recently, I think some of the justices did fall off the turnip truck on their way to law school. But back in 1870, when the court got stuck at nine, there were nine circuits. Justices were required to ride circuit and hear cases in those circuits and respond to emergency petitions from those circuits. Country's gotten a lot bigger since 1870. We're now 13 circuits plus the circuit for D.C., and so I don't think it's illogical to have 13 justices responsive to 13 circuits. And let's throw back in riding circuit, because if the court's only taking 50 some odd cases per year, which is the lowest by a large margin in over a century, then they've got time to do other things like ride circuit. And also those senior justices who we talked about can continue to ride circuit while they're on senior status.
Yeah, but here's the thing. If they're doing that circuit thing that you're talking about, they don't get to go to Alaska on great trips. They don't get to drive around the country in their RV. They don't get to do a lot of the things that, the perks of the job, if you will.
This is the world's smallest violin playing for them if they don't get to do that.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, because clearly, everybody I talk to, at some point is upset with the courts. How do we get this move through? How do you see this playing out? Because I got to tell you, as someone who's fairly jaded, and I admit it, I don't ever see another constitutional amendment being put on the books in my lifetime. I hope I'm wrong on this, but I just don't see it. So what's the path forward?
I mean, I'm a cynic, but I'm hopeful. I think it comes down to I did a virtual panel with Erwin Chemerinsky and Akhil Amar, who are two giants of constitutional law, literally wrote the constitutional law textbooks that I used way back in the day. And they said something that I think is critical is it comes down to the ballot box. And if people who want good government are able to control government, then you will get good government. If you have people who want to tear government down root and branch and have a Hobbesian type of society where life is nasty, cruel, brutish, and short, then you're going to get that. It matters at the ballot box at the end of the day.
No, I mean, and I 100% agree with that. And, simplistically put, are you going to build a house or are you going to tear it down? But as my grandfather always said, it takes 20 years to become a carpenter to build a house. Any idiot with a hammer can tear it down. And it seems like we've got a lot of idiots with hammers.
Why are you being so mean to Lauren Boebert? That's just not appropriate. No, I agree. It's and I think that's one of the things that we need to get back to. Like over the course of the last 8 years, we've just been accustomed to being enraged and being beaten down and not having a modicum of hope. We're just trying to put out the fire. And I think that now we have seen, there's hope for change. There is hope to be able to build things again. There's a growing sense of community across the country that America is not a terrible place that needs to be great again. I think America is not going to curse. I think America is a damn fantastic place, and we can all join together to improve upon it instead of tearing each other down constantly.
And I'm 100% with you. Say it all the time. We're not a burning hellscape. Our cities aren't on fire, as the outrage machine keeps trying to tell us. And you're right. This is still the greatest place to live, in my view, on the planet. So let's make it better and leave it to our children. Leave them something worth inheriting. But Devin, I appreciate the thoughts, the expertise. As always, great talking with you.
Preach, Rick. I appreciate it.
Devin Ombre, Senior Director for Courts and Legal Policy there at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org, the website. You definitely want to take a look at the stuff that they're doing. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Should we be holding justices accountable like the rest of us? And should presidents be accountable? Seems like common sense. Want to hear your thoughts? rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see mostly cloudy skies here in the overnight with just a few showers and storms developing. Upper 60s at sunrise, the winds light. On Wednesday, we'll have a slight chance of showers and storms around the area. Partly sunny skies and upper 80s. It's 78 at our studios.
Matt Nair on air.
We were talking about Donald Trump. He also said that he knows how to correctly pronounce Kamala Harris's name. He just chooses not to. And so I think that kind of opens it up for us to take some liberties.
Yeah, what would be your fix to the name?
Dave from New Berlin texting in Conald.
Conald.
Dump. Also, Calvin's was Donald Trump.
Who said there's a correct one?
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays at 11 on Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX and the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, last Friday, there was a big event in Franklin Borough, Pennsylvania, just outside Johnstown, that saw California Congressman Ro Khanna talk about his recently introduced Steel Modernization Act and roll out what his vision for what a state-of-the-art, green, unionized steel industry could possibly look like in the country. And he said, look, I know politicians say a lot of stuff. I know they make a lot of promises. But he said, look, this is what I'm fighting for because this is the future, not just of the country, but of the planet as well, moving towards sustainable manufacturing and good jobs along with it. And here to share some thoughts on this Steel Modernization Act of 2024. I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it is great to be with you as always.
So the Steel Modernization Act of 2024, do we still have a steel industry?
We do. I mean, a few years ago it made headlines because there were factory closures. And obviously before that, it was one of the bedrocks of our manufacturing economy in a lot of communities around the country, including Johnstown, Pennsylvania, by the way, where there was a large Bethlehem steel mill that now sits vacant. And it's a sign, it's a site I know you see around the Midwest as well, which is a lot of these towns that were anchored by a mill. And, it takes generations to come back from something like that. But, I think the importance of having an effort to revitalize steelmaking in this country is very important because it's a foundational material of just about everything that we do. If you think about all the clean energy products, whether it's automobiles, EVs, right? Or wind turbines or solar panels or electrical chargers or, a new and efficient transmission grid, all of that has a lot of steel in it. And so I think that it's important to understand that this is part of our economic future as well. And it's better to do it here, clean and green with good jobs, than to depend on carbon intensive imports coming from China, which makes 55% of the world's steel, right? And so that's one of the reasons. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why I'm excited about this effort, but I think fundamentally that's one of the reasons why I'm very excited about it.
No, look, as a kid growing up in Cleveland, the steel mills were, you know, an integral part of the entire fabric of the economy. You know, the entire flats, the part of Cleveland that had most of the steel mills, you know, that was just bustling with employment, bustling with opportunities and prosperity. Also, a lot of pollution. So this idea that we can maybe recreate what once was, maybe not in the, you know, the hundreds of thousands of jobs that Bethlehem Steel had, but in a way that's going to get good employment, create the stuff that we need, and do it in a way where maybe a kid my age when I was growing up during that period doesn't suffer from asthma because of the pollution.
Yeah, whether it's the local source point pollution or the carbon output, which impacts the globe, it is important to begin that process of decarbonizing the industry. And there are technologies that are available to do that. The issue is they're new technologies. They're quite expensive at this point. And so it takes some public facility basically to offset the costs of doing that, and whether it's tax breaks or grants, I mean, there'll be a return, you know, in the future with those good jobs paying taxes back into the community. So there'll be a massive return that way, but you kind of need that upfront capital, Rick. Right. I mean, this is the thing. It's like, it's easy to start up a software company. All you have to do is find a couple of engineers anywhere in the world. And then when you're making changes to it, you just add a couple of hours on that way. You don't hardly need any physical infrastructure to do that. To make things, you need a physical infrastructure, right? And you need machine tools, and you need expensive equipment, and you need really highly skilled workers. And actually, yeah, you're right. You're not going to have 10,000 highly skilled workers in the facility, but you could still have 1,000 or even 2,000. And so that costs money. And it makes sense to do that. And now we have kind of a proof point. And this is why I'm glad like Ro Khanna is involved with this. You know, he represents Silicon Valley in California. Companies like Apple and Google, you know, are in his district. And so he knows what innovation, what modern economics looks like. And he was one of the authors of the CHIPS and Science Act to create a program that would help to bring high-tech semiconductor manufacturing back to the United States. We used to do one out of every three high-tech semiconductor chips in the United States a generation ago. And now we make about, you know, 10% of the world's semiconductors, even though we consume a lot more of them. And China, you know, has really scaled up. And so, you know, the CHIPS and Science Act is something that was passed and it had bipartisan support, one of the few things that did over the last couple of years. And now you see the results of this. I mean, there's semiconductor factories going up all over the country, in Indiana and Ohio and Minnesota and in New York upstate and in Texas and Arizona and many other places as well. And you know, but it costs money to do that. And CHIPS and Science Act recognizes this. And so you're basically applying the same template to the steel industry and saying, we want to make the next generation of steel here in the United States. And we want to make even more of it because we do import, you know, a fair amount of steel right now. And we want to be more self-sufficient in all of that, Rick.
Yeah, and look, as we're talking about reinvesting in our infrastructure, wouldn't it be nice to be able to reinvest in our infrastructure with products and things that were made here? And I know there's a Made in America provision to a lot of this stuff, but unfortunately, there's a lot of stuff we don't make anymore. And it would be nice to bring some of that manufacturing back.
Yeah, I know last time we talked, I think we talked a little bit about the transformer factory that Cleveland-Cliffs is building in the panhandle of West Virginia. Well, there's an example right there. We don't make enough transformers in this country And we know that we're becoming a more kind of like electric economy in every sense. And so you need those transformers. And so to have that domestic capacity is going to be very important. And so that's, yeah, that's the same with steel. We're going to continue to need a lot of it, even though it's obviously a legacy industry that's been around for a long time. And the point of this bill is basically to say, you know what, let's invest first in the communities that suffered a lot of the distress from the layoffs that we saw in manufacturing. And part of this, and I know, you know, the former mayor of Pittsburgh was there, Bill Peduto, and he made a really good point, is like, it's in our DNA. Like, we know how to do this. We've done this for generations. If someone gives us a chance, we know how to make steel. And so all we need is that opportunity and that marriage of a little bit from the private sector, a little bit from the public sector, some good standards. And again, the backstops that we have in the form of tariffs on dirtier imported steel, you know, a domestic market for this. And we could make this happen. And it's pretty exciting. So it was actually kind of like, you know, one of those moments where you're like, someone finally gets it. And so I do think, you know, I don't expect this thing to pass this year, but I it's never going to pass unless that conversation gets started. And now it has. And to kind of Congressman Khanna's great credit, you know, he's included the labor side of this through the steelworkers. He's included the company side this by engaging with the industry groups and folks like us. And he's included the environmental community and also the communities that have been impacted by all of this. And so I think this is kind of like economic development legislation done the right way by involving all the stakeholders at the outset.
Now, the interesting thing for me is, and I know I'm going to get a bunch of email on this because my anti-Green New Deal people are going to lose their mind because we're talking about anything green. The idea that this is going to be green, it's got to be bad. And for me, it's about having that conversation of what kind of a future do we want to have? And then using this in the moment to go, which political ideology is moving toward, you know, sanity and reality and which is, stuck, 100 years ago. And for me, this is a good talking point, because as you said, it's not going to pass this legislative session. Republicans are going to do nothing in the House to move anything like this along. Although they should. I mean, this is a very pro-business thing as well. But it's about, for me, having that conversation of what the future could look like and doing it not as just a way of we're saving the environment, but we're also saving the working class of this country.
Yeah, we are. And we're creating opportunities that haven't been there for a generation, basically. And so we know what is possible. Like, if we're given a fighting chance, and so like if there are, for instance, tariffs in place against that overcapacity or that dirty steel, like we know that our industry can stabilize, and it has actually. It's been hiring people at plants, in Pennsylvania and Ohio and in Indiana and other states where there wasn't any hiring for a long time, right, in the steel mills. So they're hiring folks. Yeah. And so just think what would be possible if we grew our capacity to a higher level as well. I mean, we can do this. And so I like that this imagines the economy of the future. It's not about a Green New Deal. This is about a better deal for all of us.
And just imagine if we produced what we need. I mean, not even talking about world production, talking about just domestic production. Because as I've said a million times, I'm a big supporter of domestic production for domestic consumption. We should make what we need and trade for the things that we can't produce. Steel, most certainly, most definitely, one of those things that we can produce.
Yeah. And this is the point, and this is what sets us apart from what China is doing and others are doing. Our goal here isn't world domination and to knock out all the other competitors, right? That is not the goal. Our goal is to make more of what we consume here and to achieve balance, right? And that is like harmony, balance. That's a lot different than what China is trying to do, which is wipe out everybody else and dominate the world and create the world's biggest firm so that they set the market, they set the rules, and they dominate. And then unfortunately that gives them way too much control over the supply chain. So we're like, let's take back some of that control and let's do it the right way. Let's do it by investing in workers, you know, and let's do it by making sure that when we're making steel, looking ahead, that we're lowering the carbon content eventually down to nothing, and that we're doing it in a responsible way so that the communities where these mills are going to benefit as well. And so this is like, again, this is like what economic development should look like. And it has nothing to do with green or any color other than red, white, and blue, basically.
There you go. And interesting you brought up overcapacity, because we both know China is producing way more than they could possibly domestically consume. And the idea is to do exactly what you said, take over global markets, be able to destroy other countries' domestic production, and thus, you know, raising the prices so that they eventually profit off basic mercantilism. But, yeah, you know, it's interesting that, you know, this past week, since our last conversation, I've gotten a considerable number of emails from people who are kind of saying the same thing, which is, you know, hey, I love the show. I agree with most of the things you say. But on this China thing, you know, China could be good for the working class because, you know, open trade with China, we don't fight wars. We've heard that. We get cheaper goods. It could lower inflation. There's so much of this. It almost seems like coordinated messaging.
Yeah. Well, whether it's coordinated or not, it's wrong. And that's the important thing. And so the idea that you've built up a juggernaut that's so big that it controls the price, it controls the market, and it can disrupt the supply chain at any point, that's way too much power to any individual actor to yield, especially, again, when their stated goals through these five-year plans is to become the largest producer of X or Y or Z and to set the rules for it. Like, this is what they want to do. And so yeah, there are occasions where you get a good price out of that, right? If that's all you're thinking about is that initial cost at the point of sale. But unfortunately, that's not the way that real economics work, because there is a cost in the long run, too. It's like, you know, if your wages continue to go down because there aren't good job opportunities, that makes your country poorer. If there is a supply chain disruption and you're dependent on China, then you're going to be last in line, and it's going to take you the longest time to catch up after there's a problem. And guess what? We have seen this. Like, we know what this looks like. And so it is very tempting to like be lured by that sugar rush, right? But it is not a sustainable model of development, and it's not the direction that we want to go. And look, you can differ about whether China is going to be belligerent or not. And it is true that, you know, hopefully the risk of armed conflict is low. I hope it stays that way. But what you can't do is, if it's trying to bully us economically, say, go ahead and do that. I mean, that's not how you deter aggression. And I'm not so sure that there isn't some malintent here. I mean, look what's happened in Hong Kong. I mean, Hong Kong used to be free. Yeah. It's not free now. Ask how people in Taiwan feel about all of this, or anybody trying to form an independent union in China, which is impossible, right? And so there is not, you know, it's not a good model. I mean, we don't want to, those supply chains are not ethical.
The reality is everything will be fine if you just keep giving us your industries. I mean, what the guy from the Heritage Foundation say? We're in the middle of the second revolution, and it'll be bloodless if the left allows it. So if you keep giving in, if you don't put up any fuss, yeah, everything will be fine. But the second you open your big mouth, well, we're gonna come after you. And that's kind of how I see these emails. Going, hey, there's all of this other stuff that you're not seeing. And it again, I come back to it seems coordinated.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, there's a lot of vested interest in the United States and globally in terms of ensuring that pipeline of cheap Chinese imports keeps coming into the United States. It fattens the profits of some of the big retailers. It certainly, you know, from an economic security point of view, it makes us less economically secure. So for people who are looking to weaken that, but there's no good reason why you want to listen to these folks.
No, I'm with you. You know, you said a minute ago, though, you said we're on a sugar rush. The sugar rush feels good, you said, but we've been addicted to this sugar for, you know, not 20 yeah. years. It's going to be hard to break this addiction to cheap stuff. And look, you know, it's not so cheap anymore. I mean, in the old days, you could argue the cheap, you know, garbage coming in from China was cheaper. But now, not so much, especially when, because I was promised, you go to the store and you'll have a choice between the cheap Chinese thing and a good quality American product. Well, that good quality American product, long gone.
Yeah. Yeah, the retail model of providing like three levels, like good, better, best, right? That's kind of how they do it. It's like that used to be the case. You're right. You know, where it, but now even, you know, the fancy brands make their stuff in China. They charge just as much as they would make it here, and they get all the profits. Yeah. And yeah, you might get $50 off, but in the long run, is it worth it to lose, you know, an entire ecosystem of manufacturing and lose that capability? That seems to me to be folly. And as if we've learned nothing from the pandemic and all these other disruptions, is that, yeah, we want the capacity to make some of the stuff here, because otherwise we run into life and death situations, unfortunately.
I'm right there with you. But Scott, as always, great stuff. I look forward to seeing this Steel Modernization Act move forward, at least in discussion, and figure out how we change the country. Scott, I appreciate the time.
Rick, thank you so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
As always, our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Check out the work that they do, AmericanManufacturing.org. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day that U.S. President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed Medicare into law. This federally funded health care program provides assistance to one of the country's most vulnerable populations, the elderly. At the time the law was enacted, many seniors found it difficult, if not impossible, to get private health insurance. President Johnson signed the law in a ceremony in Independence, Missouri, the hometown of former President Harry Truman. While in office in the 1940s, Truman had proposed a national health insurance plan. Unfortunately, he was unable to get his plan through Congress. President Johnson wanted to recognize Truman's efforts. At the bill signing ceremony, President Truman received the very first symbolic Medicare card. The law went into full effect in 1966. 19 million people registered for the benefit. One of the labor leaders who fought for Medicare was Nelson Hale Cruikshank. Nelson held several positions for the AFL-CIO, and he spent his career advocating for social insurance protections for working people. He earned the nickname the Father of Medicare. The same year that the Medicare law was passed, Cruikshank explained why he thought it was so important to reform health insurance. He said, quote, "In too many doctors' offices today, the Hippocratic Oath has given way to the Dow Jones average. By 2010, 48 million Americans received their health insurance through the Medicare program. 8 million were people with disabilities. The rest were seniors. The program has had a tremendous impact on the quality of life of millions of older Americans. Yet, since its inception, there have been those who aim to make it less accessible by scaling back benefits and raising the eligibility age."
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, I love the idea of the Steel Modernization Act that Ro Khanna has rolled out. This idea, and look, we've talked about this for a while. The idea of going to those places that used to be Johnstown, used to be a major, major steel producer in this country. Cleveland used to be a major steel producer. You know, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, big steel producing. A lot of places out in California, you know, in Gary, Indiana. You know, there was a lot of production of this vital resource, this basically the building block for everything, from our roads and bridges to, you know, the widgets and whatnots that we demand every day. So having that capacity to build the products that we need here at home is something that makes me very happy. And this is one of those vision things. Look, it's not going to pass Congress. The Republican-controlled House, not going to pass anything like this on any level in this moment. This is where we, the voting populace, has to get out and vote for people like Ro Khanna who have the vision for what the future could be. It's one of the reasons that I was such a big fan of Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, when he was running for president. In fact, he was a notch ahead of Biden at the time. I think Joe Biden has done an incredible job of picking the very best policies and moving forward on them on the manufacturing front. We got that CHIPS bill. We got the infrastructure bill. We got a lot of stuff that's doing this just not on the level that I would like to see. And I see this is a good direction. And that's why from this point forward, this election should be about direction. You know, what's the vision for the future? Is the vision making those places that used to be the places of the future? Or is it about, you know, wailing on the past and complaining and well, what Trump does masterfully? Lots of grievance politics. Instead of saying, hey, we have a vision for the future, let's all start marching in this direction to get things done, actually fix our problems. You've got the grievance folks who want to just, they want to just complain about, well, the problem instead of having a solution. This idea that we're going to bring Bethlehem Steel back and they're going to employ 100,000 people at a facility, that's not going to happen. But the reality is we need steel. We need good jobs. As Scott Paul pointed out, it might be 2,000 or 3,000 jobs, not 100. But it's still helping us. And you think about, you know, we talk about trade a lot, and I'm a big supporter of trade. I think with like you know, economies, you have an open back and forth trade because you're somewhere in the same ballpark. Your wages, your conditions, your benefits, all that stuff are somewhere near the midline. I don't know how you continue to compete with a desperation country, a race to the bottom kind of situation like we have with China. You're never going to work in this country for the wages that they work for. You're never going to allow the environmental policies that they allow companies to get away with. You're never going to allow the lax, you know, labor regulations. It's never going to happen here. And we're certainly not going to allow the abuses that we see there. At least I hope not. And this is where, you know, I look at someone like Donald Trump and I go, you know, is it possible they want to bring desperation again? I mean, you look at the Supreme Court, this idea that, well, we're going back to the good old days of the Lochner era, where if you're hungry enough and desperate enough for work for poverty wages and deplorable conditions, hey, that's your freedom. It's your liberty. And I guess this moment is not so much about the cult of personalities. You know, I like Kamala Harris. I think Donald Trump is amusing. But it's the vision for the country that I think is important. I remember a time when we made the things we needed. I remember a time when jobs were there for people to have and were able to support a family on. But I also lived through the free trade era, where it's gonna be great because we're gonna get cheap stuff. And you think about the millions of manufacturing jobs that were lost, the hundreds of thousands of auto worker jobs that were lost. And then you get into, you know, the agricultural and the textile and, you know, furniture. We used to make furniture in this country. North Carolina was the furniture capital. Textiles, huge. We used to have electronics, you know, companies. We used to have these two call centers. And now this outsourcing mentality that they're now trying to outsource into automation and robotics is something that I think the American workers should be concerned with and should be fighting back against. And this is where, you know, I look at someone like Ro Khanna and I say, you know what? Someone has a vision that I can get on board with. Someone has a vision for the future that is going to, you know, help us, you know, deal with the environment, but more importantly, going to help people survive today. You know, it's a luxury to think about 10 years from now when you can't afford to keep the lights on today. It's a luxury to worry about what's going to happen in 10 years when you can't put food on the table or keep a roof over your kid's head. Yeah, it's a nice thought to, hey, we want them to be able to survive and, you know, and, you know, to live their lives in 50 or 60 years. When you're worried about today makes it a little more difficult. So the fact that we can have this a just transition and labor being at the front of it, I think is a great thing. So good on Ro Khanna. In fact, you know, while we're at the DNC, we're going to sit down with Ro and get him back on the program. But I want to hear your thoughts. Is this a smart thing? Is this something we should be doing more of in industry after industry? Or is this just, it's part of that green garbage? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast, freespeech.org for the video. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time.
You're listening to Mad Radio.
WMDX 1580 AM Columbus. W224 EG Madison.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC